Hello everyone, and welcome to The Laundromat, the podcast dedicated to compliance professionals. In each episode, we welcome a different guest and discover his background, missions, craziest stories, and much more. Today, we receive Thomas Bow, our first German guest and also a seasoned financial crime expert. Over the years, he developed a keen expertise, especially during his time at the neobank N26, where he was head of AFC and broke money laundering reporting officer. Now, he is the founder and CEO of Burfin Advisory, a Berlin-based company who specializes in tackling the challenges of financial crime for its clients. Hi, Thomas, and thank you for accepting to be a guest.
Hi, Baptiste. Happy to be here, happy to speak to you about this great topic. And I must say, your first podcast was actually quite nice to hear, and I hope we have a similar experience today. Just one thing, I saw some comments about your friend's past as a criminal, and actually must say that it's actually beneficial in financial crime to have a background understanding how the other side looks like. So for example, when I was starting my career, I was working for a law firm where we were actually setting up these complex company structures. They were not illegal per se, but it helped me to understand on the money laundering perspective then how these large corporations work and also how they're working. So happy to be here and happy to have a great conversation today. Thank you.
Thank you for your kind words. I will tell it to my friend because actually I agree with you. He turned out to be a great guy and now he's doing an amazing work to prevent fraud. So the story ends well. So to begin, could you please tell us what you are up to at Burfin, the company you founded a little bit less than a year ago?
Yeah, sure. Happy to do so. I mean, at Burfin, so we're a financial crime company that offers basically services and advisory to financial institutions, primarily financial fintechs, neobanks, crypto institutions, for example, to help in the financial crime prevention. That comes with various degrees. So from a practical experience, we have the experience in how to investigate cases, but also how to manage, build financial crime programs. And also around that, how do we operate with the regulator? How do you deal with crises, for example, incidents in the best way? And this is basically what we're doing. So from a traditional perspective, it's advisory. And then we also have services where essentially we are offering what we can do for our clients. That includes things like advanced investigations, which is one of our best services where we are actually going into the client and helping them identify severe financial crime, which includes radical entities, terrorism, and organized crime, and to basically help them to identify it, report it, and basically get rid of them if needed.
Okay. And what size of company do you work with? Any size or more small, medium? And do you have any preference?
We're focused on the fintechs. So in that sense, the fintechs can come in varying sizes. So we work with companies who are quite small. So in the beginning stages, we're just building up their structure. So then obviously it's a different task. And there are the more established ones which already have a large customer base and which also may have come already into some issues with financial crime.
Okay, well, that makes sense. And does your missions have an end, or can you provide externalization services for smaller companies that do not have the resources within the company?
Yeah, exactly. So part of our offering is that we're also taking over the function, obviously, and we're providing all of the tasks that are necessary to do it. For others, it's more ad hoc, and others it's more on a recovering basis. So basically, we come in every 6 months, for example, at one of our clients to help them against severe financial crime. So we look into their customer base. If something has changed, we're applying the new patterns, topologies that we have acquired, and then basically checking it against those to see if there's some new exposures on their side.
Okay. Yeah, that's very clear. And I'm curious because I'm an employee myself. I've been my whole career. And I've thought a few times to start my own company, but it's kind of scary and it's a big leap in the unknown. So in your case, after several years as an employee for various companies, what motivated you to start this new, I would say, professional adventure?
I think the answer lies in the question already. So obviously it's an adventure. It's something really great to do because you operate with a high degree of freedom that you would not have otherwise. And also you can really focus on topics that you want to do. And for me, it's pushing this topic of financial crime prevention the best way I can, which includes basically advancing it on a topical perspective. So how do you tackle financial crime, but then also on a strategic level? So how do you prevent financial crime in the long term and also structurally in those financial institutions which are not built or designed to prevent this type of crime? And the last part is then this academic part. So we are also actively cooperating with NGOs, for example, and working with them on thought leadership. So really trying to establish certain terminology and typologies that also others can use. And I think being, you know, like having this company is the best way to do so. The other part, obviously, is I like to build stuff. This is what I've done in 26, for example. That's what I'm doing also in this business. And I really enjoy doing that because you can work with great people while doing so, and you can really see the effect that you can have on the companies, but also on the sector itself.
Okay, and tell me if I'm being a bit too noisy, but in terms of hours, moving from like full-time position within a big company with like a work convention and so on, are you working much more than you were before? Is it reasonable?
I mean, I would guess the people in my private life would probably say it's not reasonable, but to be honest, I don't see much difference than working in the fintechs I've worked before in, because it is a high pace environment I was working in before with high hours, long days, and today's days are not different. The only thing is obviously that having worked at such a high pace environment before and actually have gone through most of these things that I'm now seeing, you can cope with them much better, and you can also tackle them in a much better time. So I'm obviously able to cover much more ground than I was able to like a couple of years ago because of the experience that I have. So it's actually more manageable, but obviously it's still long hours, not going to lie.
Yeah, I can imagine. But what I've heard, I never done it myself, but working for yourself is also in a way not the same feeling. Do you concur with that?
Yes, I could agree with that. On the other hand, I think the one thing you always need to consider is that if you are burning yourself, so you're working every day until 2 or so in the morning or so, and you're not going to be able to perform, and you're not going to be able to deliver the best you can to the clients and to the people around you. And this is what you always need to take into consideration. I'm actually the first one who will probably tell my people, please like consider your working hours and do as much as you can, and then also stop at some point. Because if you burn yourself for this, you're not going to, it's going to be hurtful for everybody around.
I could not agree more. Sometimes taking a rest is actually the right business decision to come back stronger and with like a more rested mind. So I have to ask, N26 is such a big name in Europe. And what was it like to be the head of AFC, Anti-Financial Crime, and also the group money laundering officer of such a big institution?
It was quite a challenge, obviously. But it was something great, because you don't get the opportunity to really build something very often. And when I started out, I was starting out with a basically blank approach. So I was able to basically just go ahead and build whatever I was thinking about. And the best part of N26 was definitely the people. I had a great team, a very great team, very good people. Most of them are now in other financial institutions, leading roles. They're extremely smart people. And so that always made it quite easy to deal with all of these situations that we had there. It was definitely also not 9-to-5. And where we speak about work-life balance before, this was obviously not the best work-life balance at some points working there. But I always felt like that we were able to do things in a great way, and that we actually apply things in a much more innovative way and much more straightforward way than you would see at other institutions. And it was really cool. And to be honest, it was also for me, obviously, a great, great opportunity to build those skills that I anticipated having also, but I was actually going to confirm and build upon it at N26.
Okay, and when you joined, how big was your team, and how much did it grow while you were working there?
Yeah, so when I started, so actually when I had my interview, we were, I think it was below 10. It was like maybe 5 people or so. I can't remember properly. But then when I joined, we were already above 10 people, and the team actually grew like crazy. So within 6 months or so, we increased staffing by like 6-7 times or so. We had about like 150 people or so after a year of being there, and it was just building it up.
And the crazy part was, usually you have this hiring maniac, which happens with these fintechs when they grow, which N26LP did. But it was also, you know, building up structures at the same time, building up processes, improving tools, improving technology around it. So it was all of it at the same time. And to manage that couldn't have been possible without the support of the people that we had and also the support of the leaders that I was working with. And that was really great to see the first year or so with building it up.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And at the end, how many people were under your supervision?
At the maximum, I would say it was like around 160, 170. That was the maximum that was with me. That was the maximum.
Oh, wow. That's absolutely huge. I'm very impressed. I thought you would say something around 50 or something like that. Wow.
I must say it has gotten bigger since then. So it has even grown further, which shows just the importance of this topic. I've talked to a lot of fintechs over the last years, and staffing has been absolutely astronomical. There has been something we have been also looking at through our company is operational staffing, but also general staffing. I mean, it's increased by like 200, 300, 400% or so in the last 5 years with these businesses. And I don't think it's going to stop.
Yeah, that's a good thing. I think more and more financial institutions, banks, neobanks, they start to understand the cost of non-compliance. So they act in a preemptive way, which is, in my opinion, much better, especially for us professionals in this field.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the best opportunities to get into the field. I think it's only going to get more interesting and more people will have a great time because it's a very interesting topic that gets more attention now and that comes with a lot of good perks.
It
is. That is true.
And how old were you when you were managing this quite big team?
I was in my late 20s. So like it's only a couple of years gone, so you can probably imagine how old I am. But it was obviously like a big challenge at a young age, let's put it this way. And it wouldn't have been possible without the people and the team around me, and also just the mentors, the leaders that I had before. So it's not mentioned, but before that I was working for a traditional bank, so Deutsche Bank, which might not sound so great anymore for many people. So, but actually it was a very good time I had there. And actually I had a very good people leaders around me. So my first boss who brought me into Deutsche Bank, he really pushed me. He helped me on my master thesis, for example, on money laundering. So like really pushed me on that side and just supported like having me done my master thesis at the same time I was working there. Then my second boss essentially for the European and APEC operations team pushed me as well. He put me on projects where I had no place to be at that time because I was even younger. And I was handling like huge remediation projects putting people from India back to Germany and from Germany to India and so on, dealing with like MROs from Singapore, Japan and so on. And they entrusted me and they really pushed me. They helped me a lot. And that was the reason I was also able to do this in the beginning. I was also always chosen. And then obviously in 26, I worked with really good people. So my team was really good. I had really great people that really were able to think and do stuff that I couldn't do and that I wouldn't do. And then also just the people that like were like in leadership positions around me, like the current general counsel, for example, a big shout out to her. She not only hired me, but she was also always a tough person to talk to in that sense, because she was able to, you know, push you to things that you wouldn't do beforehand or so. And she was really able to get me on another level. And then also just, you know, the managing directors around me, also they also really helped me. So that essentially helped me to take this role and do this role in the best ability that I was able to.
Okay. So if I try to summarize the formula to get such a like a high responsibilities job at a very young age, considering you have to hire the right people, and of course that makes a lot of sense. You have to find the right mentors that will trust you and give you these interesting missions that help you to grow as a compliance professional. Are there any other, I don't know, secret tips or things like that you've applied in order to get where you are now?
I mean, I think the other thing is have the right friends around you. I think that's also important. I actually only applied for the position as the head of AFC for N26 because a friend of mine said like, hey, Thomas, you would be the right person to do it. And I would never have applied actually for that position or so. That really helped. And I think this is super important, having the right people around you and also just being humble enough to ask for help and for advice. I think that's super important. Those are for me the secret tips.
Yeah, I think I agree with all the recipe myself. It's very important. There is no doubt. Another question, and maybe afterward, I will leave you alone with N26, but I'm just this company. What was your biggest challenge there? And also, it might be a different story, but the craziest thing that happened. So it might be the same one, but it may be two. I will just let you answer.
I think the biggest challenge is for me, the biggest learning ground there was just dealing with the politics that comes with high-level positions and that comes with bigger companies. I think this is something where I learned a lot, and this is also what I actually am applying a lot for my current clients. So usually I try to navigate for them the muddy waters that sometimes can be bigger companies and to try to help them with that, because that's usually where us money laundering officers have a tough part, because we're not the most favorite people, because we're going to say no to business or like say maybe not this way or another way or so. So I think it's really important how to communicate and how to operate with people from various backgrounds and different backgrounds. I think this is something that I see with people with 20 years experience do horrible. I see people who are really struggling with that, and that's why I'm trying to help them. And it's also why I struggled personally with a lot. The other part I would say is dealing with the fintech environment. That was obviously also difficult. It was a challenge in that sense that you're working in a space where the customer base is growing exponentially, but also the products are growing like crazy, and innovation is always there. So usually innovation outpaces regulation by far. So you need to think about how can I take this innovation and put it into the right control framework that is required from the law, and also to do something sensible and do something that makes sense for the business, but also for the financial crime prevention. Because, and this is something I wanted to also share, is that I'm a firm believer that compliance and financial crime are further and further moving apart. So whereas compliance is like, how do you ensure minimum regulatory requirements? How do you ensure that law is being followed? Is that financial crime, on the other hand, is more, how do you effectively stop the risk that you're seeing? How do you mitigate that? How do you get rid of it? Or how do you accept it? And that sometimes surpasses law, but that also sometimes goes into spaces where no law exists right now. So for example, crypto spaces. So I think this is also super, super challenging in any fintech, and especially what I also experience, obviously. In terms of the craziest story, I'm a big fan of financial crime stories. Some of them I can't tell, sadly, because I don't want to go break some laws or so. But one thing I wanted to share is they're coming with the maturity of the customer base and just the overall people that you're dealing with. So we had fraudsters. I think that's not secret news, because basically there's news articles around and this kind of thing. And the funniest or the craziest thing was that we had a fraudster who lost about, I think, 400 euros or so, because we were able to stop the money. And he then proceeded to send pictures of the close proximity of the office during Christmas time, where nobody was in the office, luckily, and was trying to, you know, show that he was close to the office and wants his money or so. That was quite crazy, because like it was my third or fourth week actually, and I thought like, oh, this is going to be interesting if that happens every week. And so that was quite funny. It actually got resolved quite easily. We think he never was at the office, but he probably just used pictures from Google, but he was quite adamant about getting his money back.
Yeah, some fraudsters are really crazy. And circling back to what you said about the communication, in my opinion, I don't know if you concur, but I think that it's actually more important to be a good communicant than actually the core skills of AML in general. Because I feel like, in a way, after 3, 4, 5 years in the field,
if you're not bad at your job, of course, you start to have like a very good understanding of what are the rules, how to apply it, what are the processes, the tools, and so on. But being able to actually make the business and the other partners within the company understand that what you are doing is actually benefiting everyone, even though on the spot it looks like you are killing a business opportunity, it's the hardest part with the management of a big team, such like the one you are.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a big challenge, especially if you're moving away from fraud and moving into the sphere of like money laundering or terrorism financing. Especially if terrorism financing is a topic that is not understood and it's very hard to understand. Obviously, if you see terrorism financing on your platform, everybody's going crazy and everybody's going to say like, oh, we need to stop this immediately. But having the control to actually find that might sound unreasonable. Back in the past, and I think it's still applied for majority of the institutions, the terrorism financing scenarios and transaction monitoring also were usually based on certain keywords, like a person transfers 200 euros and has reference tech bomb, oh, there has to be terrorism financing. Obviously, that's nonsensical. It doesn't make any sense to do so. But this is what usually comes into mind with those people when you talk about senseless controls. And then it gets tough to discuss this with the business if you're starting with such a weak argumentation. So with what you're saying is absolutely correct, that you need to really build the message that is based on your experience, knowledge, and just overall trustworthiness, that you know what you're talking about, and build the right message around it. If you can do that, you will always get the attention of management and you will always be able to get what you need. But then also you need to say what you need and not be vague about it. I think that's the other part that I learned as well. Always be concrete what you need and why you need it and when you need it.
Yeah, clarity is also crucial. I'm also thinking that, of course, communication is key in doing our jobs in a proper way. But within a company like M26, we've just this growth opportunities within the European market. Maintaining a great customer experience, I imagine, was also deeply important. And I wonder, were you using tools to achieve that? And if so, what kind of tools, if you can disclose this information?
So to be honest, it's a little bit far away. So I would rather touch upon the point that the tools are for me not the most relevant thing. After being in this business for like over 8-9 years or so now, it's not about the tools for me. It's about the people that work on it and the people that design it and get the best out of it. I've seen tools that cost over like millions or 2 million a year or so that are supposed to deliver some great thing or so. And they're usually not able to uphold that because on the implementation of it, there are not the right people who can design it. So just because you buy a Ferrari, for example, but you've never driven a car, doesn't mean the Ferrari is going to get you to the place in the first place, for example. So for me, it's more about, do you have the right skill set and people in place? And if you do not, how can you get those people? And how can you make your own staff better at understanding what needs to be done? And then the key part for me is, how do you understand the risk that you have and what needs to be done against it? And with that being said, there are a lot of great transaction monitoring tools, for example. So you think about your Actimize, you think about your FeedSci or whatever. So they're all good tools. They have some advantages and disadvantages. But at the end of the day, it's about how do you then design the tool and how to implement it and what kind of operations is behind there that they can actually take care of those cases. And this is for me the key part. If I think about the important parts of tools, obviously it's databases, which I can recommend. So integrating any public database, but also private databases like this Nexus, BVD, also choose one of them, but also metrics, biometric databases. So for example, email addresses, telephone numbers, and all of this kind of stuff. Any data point is really good for them to use. That's really, really good. The other thing is verification tools. For example, like SummitSub does a great job. And then detection tools as well, fraud detection tools based on biometrics and this kind of thing. This is what I can recommend. But usually you don't see that in live environment because it's always work in progress with a fair institution, always.
Yeah. You know, I really liked your analogy with the cars and the drivers. But imagine if you have, of course, if you don't know how to drive the Ferrari, you will just go to the ditch and it will be there. But if you have like the best drivers, but they only have bikes, they won't achieve much also. So of course, it's a balance. You need to have the right tools and also the people that have the skills to operate them in a nice way. And when we started, I think you had the same experience. It was the caveman age. I was typing the MRZ lines at the bottom of the IDs and passports just to make sure that they were actually not tampered with. And now I have these liveness detection tools that even make sure that I'm actually onboarding the right person. And thanks to this type of tools, the volume of fraud of identity theft, they got reduced to very close to zero.
Yeah, I mean, two things on that. So yes, tools can deliver a lot of things. And there are really great tools out there that has, like, I've worked with clients who basically they integrated one tool and suddenly all of the fraud was gone. Like this. On the other hand, I think there is sometimes this misconception that certain tools will do this, that they will stop everything. I think for fraud, this is something that is doable. I think for money laundering and terrorism financing, it's much more difficult. And to believe that a tool will cover that problem is a logical fallacy, because it's way too fluid, the topic. And I've seen this especially with the crypto space, where basically the traceability of funds is like unlimited because you have the blockchain. And there is this belief that if you identify one node, which is criminal, that this will stop all criminal activity. Whereas criminals have obviously figured out that the blockchain can be traced. So the real criminals, the real organizations, they obviously are not that stupid anymore. So they have adapted, they have changed. We have seen it in every single space. So the typologies that we have thought would be like the game changers 2 or 3 years ago, they changed after a year or so, and now they're completely different. And so it's this constant vigilance and constant analysis that is required. And then you can have great tools to augment it and support it, but you need to have the internal staff that really understands financial crime. And it's not about the regulations, it's not about some documents. So it's really going into the data and sending the typologies and building from that continuously your controls.
I could not agree more with what you said. Of course, the tools alone won't do much if you don't have like people that actually know what they're doing and keep on improving their skills and understanding of the current market they're facing.
And just to, because I mentioned 2 points, so going back to the car analogy, which if you know, yes, you're right, that obviously if you drive a bicycle in a race against a Ferrari and on a straight road, you will probably lose. And a straight road is for me an institution with no financial crime issues, low risk, and nothing happens. But if you take a Ferrari down a hill with no road and only boulders in the way, then I think a Ferrari is going to crash and burn, whereas the bike will probably arrive safely where it needs to be.
Yeah. But also a very good analogy. Of course, some companies don't have to face the same type of challenges, and sometimes a tool, I imagine in this analogy, like a mountain bike is something more customizable that can actually fit the exact need of the company, will be much more efficient than an on-the-shelf tool, which is not fitting the need of the smaller company and is just going to achieve very little compared to very specials. Like, am I correct on the...
But also around the people, right? So like... sometimes you need those rugged people who are like mountain bike drivers or so, who can also fall and take a hit, because you need people who can also like cover and live through these situations. Whereas with other companies, you might need people who are just Ferrari drivers and who can drive a Ferrari, but they're probably not going to be able to withstand a fall from a mountain bike. And now we have absolutely confused everybody with our analogy.
Yes. We're going to just move to the last question, but just before that, I just have to know, Thomas, what are you? Are you a mountain bike driver? Or are you like a Ferrari driver? Maybe Mercedes? What is your...
I'm probably the person who drives the Ferrari down the hill and tries to make the Ferrari arrive safely. That's me. I'm the test driver and crash driver. Okay.
That seems dangerous, but interesting, definitely. My last question for you, and I think it's going to be interesting because as I said earlier, I'm impressed with your career path. Do you have any advice for like current students or just like very junior people starting their way in the compliance industry so they can get like a successful career just like you have?
Yeah, I mean, first is don't do compliance, do financial crime, anti-financial crime. It's much more fun. No, without joking, I think what I mentioned also before, I think it's a great time to get into the field. It's really cool what you can do. So that's a, how do you get best into it? I think I always recommend to start with a machine room position, which for me is operations. I have started operations. I was not the best operations person, but it was important for me to understand how actually cases are being done, what a SAR looks like, how an investigation is conducted and this type of thing. And this is for me the most important thing. So choose a place that allows you to do that, that is not just a service center, but work directly for a company. There's a lot of entry positions right now. It's one of the most asked fields for. So get into that and just, you know, from there on, move ahead. Once you start in the field, do reading. There are great books. Oliver Bollo, for example, great books from him. And just read, get interested into it. Don't focus too much on the certificates in the beginning. Try to get into a place where you can grow and do strategic work. And after a couple of years of operations, try to find the right place as a more strategic position also to get further into this field. And then you're going to have a great time.
Okay. Well, Thomas, I think these are very good insights and it was enlightening and a real pleasure to get to know more about you and your career. This is the word of the end. I wish you all the best in your future projects and a lot of success with Burfin Advisory. And I truly hope that our paths will get to cross again at some point.
For sure. Thank you, Baptiste. Thank you for the invite. And it was really pleasure to talk to you and also much success to the continued Laundromat. Looking forward to further episodes. And if anybody feels free, reach out to me. I'm available. Thank you.
Likewise. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.